Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and aired on Utah Public Radio around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, President Donald Trump is impeached, and a whistleblower claims that the LDS Church stockpiled $100 billion in charitable donations. Those and other stories on the show today. Joining me for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief on the phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning and welcome, Tommy.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Nate Carlisle, reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, thanks to you as well for being here, and good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. And George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, good morning, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Thomas Burr, there in Washington, D.C., you had a front row seat to some history being made this week, the impeachment of a president. And before we jump into the role of Utah's representatives in Washington in this and into what comes next, I was hoping that we could just get some of your impressions as you sat there in the House on Wednesday, because you really did have this front row seat. What was that like, Tommy?
You know, it was a very very surreal moment. This is obviously my first impeachment. When Bill Clinton was impeached, I was in college. So it was something I didn't really know what to expect. But a very interesting day. I learned a lot of how the process works, which is not well in some ways. So they began the debate around 9 a.m. Eastern time. And normally, little-known secret, you know, outside of Washington is that when people are speaking at the dais and they're speaking, it's usually an empty chamber. There's no one really there. There's a few aides and things going on. But in this situation, actually, scores of members actually came and sat in the seats and were listening to the speeches going on. And that was something that I'd never seen before. There were protests obviously going on outside, and a lot of anger boiling over. You could just tell by the speeches, especially on the Republican side, everyone's kind of vitriolic in so many ways that it had got to this point. On the Democratic side, they were trying to strike a more somber tone and talk about, you know, what they say were the high crimes and misdemeanors that the president committed and brought us to this point. But really, it was just a fascinating look at process. I likened it to, you know, it's like, you know, the ultimate score of a football game. You still got to watch the game to see how it got there.
Right.
That was the process on Wednesday.
Well, I mean, and everybody knows that it was a partisan vote and that you know, the president was impeached. I want to zero in on our representatives from Utah and their reactions to all of this, but I'm interested in kind of the behind-the-scenes reporting here as well. You know, how are you actually tracking our representatives down on a day like this? You need quotes, obviously, for your stories, but it's a busy day for these lawmakers. How do you connect with them?
Yes, I mean, it's really kind of a fun thing, and I honestly wish I could have taken a video camera with me all day and just showed people what I was doing. But for part of it, I would have set up in the gallery and, you know, watched the proceedings on the House floor. And when I could, I would run downstairs, literally run down the stairs to the second floor and go in what's called the Speaker's Lobby, where members of Congress and journalists kind of, you know, congregate. And that's where I was able to catch Congressman John Curtis was the first one I saw. Then I got Congressman Rob Bishop. I later saw Ben McAdams was on the, you know, on the floor, and I texted him to you know, see if we can meet up. And then, you know, I grabbed Rob Bishop again. Congressman Chris Stewart went out and gave a speech. But there's a lot of running back and forth and just hoping, because, you know, there are 435 members of the House, and it's not easy to track down four people sometimes.
Right. So what did these representatives, and once you did track them down, what did our representatives in the House have to say about, you know, this historic moment and how it played out? You could probably start with Representative Stewart, who is a very strong Trump supporter. What did he say?
Yeah, sure. He was one of the stronger ones who was obviously angered about the situation. As we all know, Stewart is on the House Intelligence Committee. He's one of the president's most staunch defenders during this whole process. And he went to the floor, and I'll just read his quote. "This vote, the vote this day is about one thing and one thing only. They hate this president. They hate those of us who voted for him. They think we're stupid." And he was talking about how, you know, the Democrats are trying to overturn the 2016 election, which prompted Jerry Nadler of New York, a Democrat, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, to respond, "Well, you do know that if Trump is, you know, impeached and removed, it's actually Vice President Mike Pence who becomes president, not Hillary Clinton, which got some laughs in the chamber.
You know, before actually we get the reactions of other representatives, maybe you could, you know, leaving parties aside, because it does seem like that high school sports analogy that you made earlier, remind us what the president did that led to this impeachment, you know, partisan though the impeachment may have been.
Yeah, sure. And this is one of those fascinating things that I've seen going on. These are the facts as laid out, although not both sides don't really see them the same. It's almost as if one side is saying it's, you know, snowy and freezing weather outside, and the other side is saying it's sunny and warm when they're looking at the same window. In this situation, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, had used kind of a shadow campaign of Rudy Giuliani and some advisors to essentially pressure Ukraine into announcing a couple of investigations, one into a company called Burisma, which is an energy company in Ukraine that Hunter Biden was on the board of. Of course, his dad is Joe Biden, who is running for president, one of the leading Democratic contenders. The president also wanted an investigation into whether Ukraine had meddled in the 2016 election, even though U.S. intelligence agencies all say it was Russia that meddled, not Ukraine. They are different countries. Along that line, the president had that fateful phone call with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, where he said, you know, I want you to do us a favor, and mentioned the Bidens and the CrowdStrike, the 2016 election conspiracy. This is what Democrats say is absolutely he was leveraging hundreds of millions of dollars in military and State Department aid to Ukraine, holding it back until Ukraine announced an investigation. On the other side, Republicans say, well, Ukraine got the money. There were no investigations announced, and the President Zelensky says he never felt any pressure. So you have both sides of that argument right there.
And also, I mean, right, the president's reaching out to a foreign government to try to get this investigation opened, and that looks from the outside like, you know, trying to asking for interference, that is, in the 2020 election. Democrats think that's impeachable. Republicans say, I mean, they're not saying that it's no big deal. They're saying that it's not actually about trying to influence the election, that this is about corruption, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the argument that we heard over and over again on Wednesday, that this is the president's always said he's concerned about, you know, giving taxpayer money to foreign countries, one. Two, that they're, you know, he is concerned about corruption, although the word corruption was never used in that phone call with Zelensky, between the president and Zelensky. So, you know, their arguments were tossed back and forth. The other one we note is, yes, Ukraine got the money, but they only got the money after it became public, after people started to hear that he was holding it back.
Well, let's get back to the reactions of, and we heard from Chris Stewart and him saying that this is about hate. We've got three other representatives in Washington there. What did, for example, Representative Rob Bishop have to say?
So Rob Bishop, thinks that, that this was there was no reason for all this, that at the end the House is going to impeach him, but the Senate's going to acquit him. So, you know, this is our whole process, that at the end of the day, it won't matter because nothing will actually happen, waste a lot of taxpayer money and time of Congress to get this done. And he thinks it was just a very he's a former high school history teacher, of course, and he thinks it was just a very bad day in the history of the United States to impeach a president over what he thinks are trumped up charges. John Curtis was actually one of the first guys I got when I was at the Capitol, and he pretty much was like, I just want this day to be over. You know, he's when I talked to him previously, you know, he said multiple times, you know, he doesn't think what the president did was right. He thinks it was wrong, but not impeachable, that the president, you know, shouldn't have done it. But it doesn't rise to that very high constitutional threshold of a high crime or misdemeanor.
And then there is one representative in Washington who did vote for impeachment, our lone Democrat, Representative Ben McAdams. And he announced, you know, earlier in the week that he was going to do this. He did that here in Utah. Did he actually speak during impeachment proceedings on the House floor?
He did not speak publicly. He didn't come to, like, you know, the floor and say anything. I did speak with him, despite the Trump campaign kept trying to say that he was hiding all day. I'm like, well, no, I saw him, you know, several times. But, you know, Ben McAdams is saying, you know, this was a sad day, that he feels, you know, bad that he has to make this vote, but he has to live up to the oath he took to office, which is to, you know, protect the United States, you know, against the enemies, foreign and domestic, and to uphold the the laws of the country, that no one is above the law. And McAdams made a very, very salient point, is that, similar to what Rob Bishop said, at the end of the day, this will remove the president from office. There's not enough votes in the Senate to actually convict him of the charges. Right. So while Ben McAdams did vote for both charges, both articles of impeachment, at the end of the day, it's a vote. There's nothing that actually happens.
I want to turn to what the path forward momentarily and what comes next, including that Senate trial. But George Pyle, on what happened Wednesday in the U.S. House of Representatives, on what it means for the country and what it might mean for, say, political futures. You got any thoughts there, George?
Well, it does seem, Tommy said that they didn't all go to the well and speak. We had the TV on, obviously, in the newsroom and just kept waiting for the vote. And it seemed like all 435 of them wanted to take their turn to talk. I guess it was, in a lot of cases, it was the same people back and forth over and over. And it was like, get on with it. And
me too, George. Me
yeah,
too.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. And McAdams was interesting because he's the only Democrat in the delegation. And if he had not voted for impeachment, that would have been big news. There were, three, four Democrats who didn't vote for it. One voted present. Two or three voted against it. The Republicans were completely all against it. So, you kind of don't get noticed if you stay with your party. If you buck your party, you get noticed. You get noticed a little bit more in Utah, but he did get elected in this purple district. People are going to – there were press releases from the president's campaign right away saying this is a bad day for Utah, a bad day for Ben McAdams. He's proven that he's just a Democratic lackey and doesn't think for himself. And I don't think that's fair, but, of course, I think he voted the right way. He said that he had hoped that maybe they could coalesce around some lesser thing, that the House would vote censure,
right,
which would be just kind of a rap on the knuckles and say, we don't like what you did, don't do it again. But it wouldn't be impeachment, and it wouldn't go to the Senate for trial. And as Tommy says, every expectation is that he won't be convicted, he won't be removed from office. Constitutionally, it's the House's duty to approve articles like this when they think it's warranted. I mean, some of us have been looking at this administration and going, why did it take you so long? And it would make sense if the administration and the Republicans in Congress had thought, well, he got away with selling property to the House of Saud, and he got away with his family getting all kinds of patents and copyrights in China. The emoluments clause is just shredded. I mean, no president ever in the history of the world from now on won't be able to get away with doing business with foreign countries and owing them a favor in return, because we've been letting this president do this for 3 years. And the fact that they let that go as long as they have might well have left the administration and the Republicans thinking, hey, we can get away with anything. And this Ukraine stuff is really, it's kind of hard to understand. It's you have to explain the players to everybody. What's Ukraine and what's Russia, and aren't they the same country? No, they're not. They were when there was a Soviet Union, but now Ukraine is an independent country.
And they're adversaries.
And they're adversaries. Yeah, we kind of think of all this, everything, east of Vienna is this one big block, but it isn't. They're independent countries, and they're worried about maybe after a while not being independent countries anymore because Russia still has eyes on them.
I want to circle back before we go too far into emoluments clause and other reasons that the president, according to George Pyle, who is again a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune and editorial page editor, maybe ought to have been impeached in advance of this. But just on the question of the political liability for someone like Ben McAdams, you talked about maybe here in Utah you stand out more for having done this. Is this, from your opinion, because you are an opinion writer, is this something that will be damaging to Ben McAdams?
Well, they're certainly going to try and throw it at him. And in a district where he barely won last time over an incumbent, which is hard to do, he was going to be targeted anyway. He's in a purple district. He didn't win by very much. It's a Republican state. Whether there was impeachment or not, however he voted on it, he was going to be a target. And I don't know that this makes it any worse than it would have been before, because certainly if he had voted against impeachment, there'd be the Democrats and the independents in his district would have been disappointed by that. And they probably wouldn't have voted Republican, but they might have just stayed home.
I guess, how about in terms of the makeup of the full House of Representatives and whether, you know, whether or not that's a vulnerability for Democrats in the upcoming elections?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're only having this because the Democrats took the House last time. They took the House largely because of disenchantment with the Republicans, with the administration. And Americans often like to have divided government. Even people, districts that voted for Trump voted in Democrats this last time, including this Ben McAdams district. And in some cases, it's like, yeah, let's give one party the White House and let's give the other party at least part of Congress so that not one party controls everything. You know, let's you and him fight.
Some checks and balances there.
Can I just jump
sure,
in here
Thomas.
And point out real fast? The Ben McAdams district, the president got about, 40% of the vote in 2016 in the 4th district. Of course, there was a third-party candidate, Evan McMullen, in the mix there, too. But this is not a district that is, yes, it's a Republican district, but it doesn't mean it's a pro-Trump district.
Okay.
Right, that's true.
Some analysis from Thomas Burr, Washington bureau chief with the Salt Lake Tribune. Tommy, I want to, you know, this whole process, as you said, next moves to the Senate, where it's likely that the president will, like Bill Clinton before him, be acquitted. He won't be removed from office. There's a wild card in the deck over there in the form of Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney. Or is he such a wild card, Tommy? Talk about his position on impeachment.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what he does. I spoke with the senator yesterday, for example, about this again. I spoke with him earlier this week, and he's sticking to the line that he is going to be a juror. He's going to listen to both sides of the impeachment articles, that he's actually been researching past impeachments, not just of presidents, of Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton before, but also reading impeachments that have happened of judges, which is another process the Senate's actually gone through and removed judges from office. And Romney says he's going to very much take his role seriously. He noted that the senators have to take an oath, and the oath is essentially that they will act as an unbiased juror, and that he wants to make sure he takes that that role honorably and to the very letter of the oath he's going to take. Now, will he vote with Democrats to remove the president? That's a pretty big jump for the senator, but he and some other people like Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, a few of those other Republicans who are up for re-election, if other damaging information comes out, they could be the ones that look to. That said, and sorry to continue, but it would take 20 Republicans flipping to actually remove the president from office. So that's a pretty high number to get you.
Yeah. And I mean, does that make the calculus? Well, I mean, the thing about this is that Senator Romney has been pretty critical of what, has been shown in these impeachment proceedings. He's called it troubling in the extreme, that phone call in particular. But yeah, I mean, would he vote no on removal? I mean, is it yes, no, or present the way that we had, we did have a present vote in the form of Amy Klobuchar? Is that right?
Yeah,
Tulsi
Gabbard. Those are the options. Although we could pull the late Arnold Spector voted not proven. I believe the Scottish not proven thing in the Bill Clinton trial. It would take a lot for a senator to do that. Romney is a Republican. He does agree with many of the president's policies. Maybe not his rhetoric or his tweets, but he wanted the tax cut and some of the other things that the president has pushed through. Romney is very. Very much trying to take this as a not a Republican, he's trying to literally going to be, I'm walking in like this is jury duty is his goal. Talk about Mike Lee for 2 seconds, Senator Mike Lee. I don't know how he's going to go, but I assume we'll hear about the Federalist Papers, whatever he does.
Yeah, Gail Collins had this great line. She said everybody was citing Alexander Hamilton. Somebody ought to write a play about him.
That's a good line. George Pyle, just on, before we head to a break, any comments on Romney's position on this?
Well, we use the term jury, but it's not a very precise term. The Constitution doesn't say jury. It says the Senate shall try impeachments. And usually in a criminal case, the jury doesn't make the rules. The jury doesn't come out ahead of, members of the jury don't come out ahead of time and say, I'm going to vote this way or that way. So it's an imprecise analogy. Part of the question is going to be, will Nancy Pelosi send these articles over to the Senate absent any promise that they will really have a trial, that they will really have witnesses, which they haven't always in the past. But the Senate can do whatever it wants. The Chief Justice presides, but he basically just bangs the gavel and tells people to shut up. He doesn't make the rules. The Senate makes the rules.
Right.
So if they decide that they're going to have a real trial with witnesses, they're going to drag in some of the people who didn't testify before the House committees, who might say something truly damaging that we haven't heard before. If they sit on this long enough for some of the Giuliani stuff to come out and more damaging stuff comes out, that might change some votes. But yeah, you have to have two-thirds, which means you have to have a lot of Republicans. And it says two-thirds of those present. So I suppose some of them could go to Mar-a-Lago for a weekend and not count. But
of all places.
Of all places. Or they can come to Alta and go skiing. So, you know, all kinds of things could happen. But, the betting is he won't be removed, but it's still he'll go to next year's election as an impeached president. And we would think that can't possibly help him, except it might motivate the base to turn out.
Well, it's raised the popularity of presidents in the past. Thomas Byrd, just before we actually had to do a break, I said we were going to do it then, but on the rules that might be set in the Senate for how these proceedings play out there, do you have any, I don't know, advanced knowledge of what might happen there?
Just from what we've heard from Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, that he wants essentially a quick trial. He does not want witnesses. So we're looking at something that could be, you know, less than a week almost. They'll come in maybe in the afternoon and they'll all sit there and one side will present the evidence and one side will, you know, counter that and then we'll have a quick vote. I'll also note what George is pointing out is absolutely true when it comes to the rules in the Senate. It says they make it up. And the one other thing that's really fascinating about this, yes, the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, presides. However, by a majority vote, the Senate can overrule any of his decisions. So it really is a majority-run situation.
Wow. Okay, that is Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr speaking about the impeachment of President Donald Trump in the U.S. House this week. And we are going to take a quick break on the show. When we come back, we will turn to more from this past week's news, including a whistleblower complaint about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Cruise into the new year with Utah Public Radio this year as we welcome a brand new decade and celebrate with all of you. It will be an evening of fine dining, live music, dancing, comedy, cruise ship themed photo ops, and plenty of good company. That's December 31st at the Vineyards at Mount Naomi Farms. Head to upr.org for more details and to get your tickets before they sell out. I hope to see you there.
And dance to drive the cold winter away with traditional holiday music from Hans Christian Andersen's Denmark, Galileo's Italy, and William Shakespeare's England. It's The Christmas Revels from PRI, Public Radio International.
Beginning Saturday at 8 p.m. on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, reporter Nate Carlisle, and columnist George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or tweet to us at KCPW. And we will turn now to some other news. There was other news this week other than impeachment. Nate Carlisle, one big headline from early in the week. Whistleblower claims that LDS Church stockpiled $100 billion in charitable donations, dodged taxes. $100 billion, that is a gigantic sum of money. This whistleblower filed a complaint with the IRS. Who is the whistleblower and what exactly is he saying here, Nate?
David A. Nielsen worked for investment firm called Ensign Peak Advisors. This is an investment firm that's more or less owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in his job, he was responsible for overseeing the funds, investing the funds, things like that. And he doesn't like that the LDS Church did not spend the money, or at least didn't spend it on what you might expect a church to spend it on. And that's the nature of his complaint to the IRS. As a tax-free entity, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there's some expectations that what revenues they do bring in goes back to furthering the faith or charitable purposes, things like that. And he's saying that has not happened here.
Can I ask, is, you know, we only have the whistleblower's account so far. Do we know for certain that the church is sitting on $100 billion?
Let's put it this way. They haven't offered, the church has not offered any evidence to the contrary. It looks pretty authentic. I mean, if, you know, from what we are able to corroborate. I mean, you know, names, company names and stuff like that.
Sure.
It looks authentic. Yes, it looks legitimate.
However much the church is sitting on, where does that money come from? I mean, how was that? You said an investment wing, but where is the sort of initial base of that money coming from?
Well, if again, according to David A. Nielsen's complaint, it mostly comes from tithing. He's saying that the church takes in $6 to $7 billion a year in tithing, with operating expenses of about $5 to $6 billion, which you know, depending on the year, could leave you up to $2 billion in surplus, and that excess tithing money goes into this fund. Of course, you know, once you hit a figure such as, you know, $100 billion, you're also making investment, you're curing money in the fund. And so at a certain point, the interest probably exceeds the revenue going into it. And it sounds like it's at that point now, too. So they're making money by having money.
That's not an uncommon way to make money. Nate Carlisle, this whistleblower, Nielsen, his complaint asks the IRS to take some action. What kind of action is this is requested by Nielsen of the IRS?
Well, he lists several requests of the IRS. In the synopsis is he wants the church to be taxed on this and or to start spending the money the way churches typically spend money.
There's an incentive for him to do. I mean, one of the things that people point out who are suspicious of this whistleblower say there's an incentive for him to have done this because there's almost a perverse incentive where he can reap a personal benefit. Can you also talk about his relationship with the LDS Church?
Well, yes, theoretically, he could stand to gain money through this whistleblower complaint. As far as his relationship with the church goes, I mean, he was a Mormon in good standing. That's how you get a job working for the church. He says that his relationship with the church and his employer began to sour when his wife wanted to leave the church. And that kind of precipitated his falling out with his employer. He's, according to the Washington Post article that had some more details that we were not able to get. His wife wanted him to leave the church as well, and that precipitated a separation from Ensign Peak Advisors.
Hmm. One of the things that Nielsen is asking for of the IRS is that Ensign Peak Advisors be stripped of its nonprofit status. I don't know I don't know how deeply you can go into this, but what would that mean for that? I mean, money that they hold would suddenly become taxable, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, that's the short of it. They'd be taxed pretty much like a business would, and you know, they could potentially be paying billions of dollars in taxes.
What does the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints say about this whistleblower and or this complaint?
They haven't said a whole lot except that they don't believe they've broken any laws. That's the first and foremost of their statement. They also say in so many words that the picture of Ensign Peak Advisors painted by Nielsen isn't entirely accurate. That the money does have a religious purpose, and that includes waiting for the second coming of Christ, that this money is going to be needed at that time. And that's a big tenet, of course, of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that Jesus will return. And that's why, for example, Mormons are supposed to stock up 2 years of food supplies because they expect some turmoil leading up to Christ's return.
And this is in the Washington Post article, it says that this complaint by the whistleblower says that Ensign's president, the president of this investment fund that is associated with the LDS Church. Roger Clark has told others that the amassed funds would be used in the event of the second coming of Christ, as you just pointed out. I mean, maybe I'll turn to George Pyle here, because I don't know. Does money spend at that point in time? And, you know, the Armageddon arrives, and can you spend money?
I mean, that's kind of the question is, I mean, you can understand, like, okay, if governments fall and the power grid goes down and all this other stuff happens, okay, the 2-year store of food for your family kind of makes some sense in that case. But $100 billion, what, in cash, in gold, in Swiss bank accounts? You know, does himself take checks? What is all the? But I guess, see, that's the way that maybe you could get the IRS to approve this, is because churches, even more than other, my understanding is that I'm just learning on the fly with the rest of us here, is that the rules for nonprofit churches are even squishier than the rules for nonprofit environmental organizations or newspapers.
Right.
And the other ones have to report a lot more detail and have to satisfy the IRS that all the money that is coming in is going out to a charitable purpose. For churches, it's a little squishier, and they're supposed to make charitable contributions like in proportion to their...
It just says, I think that the code is substantial. I mean, according to the reporting that I've read, is, you know, substantial, or a language that's kind of squishy on how much.
Right. There's no number. There's no, you know, if it's not expressed in numbers, it's opinion, not fact. And so they have this. And so they're able to stand up and say with a straight face, we're not breaking the law, because the law is open to such wide interpretation that they can say and apparently believe, we are hoarding this money. They wouldn't like the word hoarding. They are saving this money against a cataclysm that their religion teaches them is going to happen. And when you do that, you're following the tenets of your religion. The government isn't supposed to question the tenets of your religion, so you can do it.
A prudent reserve for the future is what the church called it in one of their statements, Nate. Right. Maybe you were going to comment on that.
Well, everyone who's covered this has gone out and found some former IRS attorney. I had no idea there were so many former IRS attorneys until this story broke. And in reading what all those attorneys have told journalists around the country, is it on the high end or low end, I guess, under perspective, they've said that if the allegations are true, yes, the church probably broke the law, but it's still unlikely the IRS would take any action, down to there's no case here whatsoever. And one of the reasons some people don't think there's a case is, remember, it's not that the church has misspent the money. Except in a couple narrow allegations about City Creek Mall, perhaps.
We can get to that, but yeah,
the bigger complaint Nielsen has is that they're not spending it at all, and that's a big difference from, you know, some church scandal where they bought mansions and prostitutes for a pastor or something like that. I mean, there's no such allegation here.
Right. Just going back to George Pyle for a second, you wrote in a column this week that churches have tax exemption for a reason, though, that there's more to your argument. Maybe you can tell us what you make of this.
Well, yeah, I've often wondered. I mean, churches are just generally tax exempt, property tax. And that's part of the reason why it's kind of hard to run Salt Lake City, because between the church and the state and the university, so much of the land in this city is property tax exempt, so it's hard to run this town. If you have a soup kitchen, if you have a homeless shelter, if you have a free kindergarten, if you have all those are things that everybody would agree is a charitable exercise. It is to some degree relieving the state of that responsibility, so you get a tax break if you give money to them, and you get a tax break if you are them and you run these organizations. The history of this has been a church which exists to get other people to join its church and get in good with the Almighty counts as a charitable, tax-exempt public benefit. And I've always wondered whether that really was true. I mean, but you can't start taxing cathedrals and temples now, because they were all built with this idea that it would all be tax-exempt. I think if you were starting a country today, you probably would say, if you are actually providing a service to the poor, to the elderly, or to the needy, that's tax-exempt. If you're building a giant building to build up your own image and build up your status, I don't know if that's a proper exemption from taxes.
George, you've on the show in various occasions talked about starting a new country. I'm waiting for your announcement on that. Here's a question. I mean, I want to get to how members of the faith are responding to this, Nate. But first, that there's also that allegation that you brought up, which is that in this complaint that the church propped up businesses like the City Creek Center shopping mall in downtown Salt Lake City or the insurance firm Beneficial Life, which this whistleblower says got a kind of bailout from the church. Can you talk about that? Does the church address that in its statements responding to this?
I mean, only in vague terms that they followed the laws. But yeah, I mean that's a big. In terms of dollar amounts, it's relatively minor. When you're talking about $100 billion to start with, $500 million or so they spent to bail out Beneficial Life the last decade and to help with the construction of City Creek Mall, it's kind of chump change. But Nielsen's point is that those were businesses that got the benefit of tithing money instead of spending the money on any other number of charitable or religious causes. And the church hasn't fully addressed that in any statements. There were statements years ago that saying that no tithing money was used on those two businesses, and Nielsen contends that's not true.
How about how members of the faith are reacting? I mean, is there a big uproar? What's the response of members of the faith? I'm sure it's across the spectrum. But
yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any comprehensive surveys on what members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints think. I mean, I can give you a couple vignettes. Mitt Romney saying he's glad they're saving up. And it ranges down to, it ranges over to Michelle Quest, who's a Salt Lake Tribune contributor, asking why is she paying tithing to an organization that's got a $100 billion reserve fund when she's trying to raise a family. I've seen a lot of members of the church say, I don't think I've seen any faithful member outright accuse the church of breaking the law. It's more to do with why do you have this size of a reserve fund and you're still asking me for tithing?
Yeah. And we have a commentary from a historian and member of the church that's online this morning saying, accepting that this is legal, accepting that there are ecclesiastical and business and security reasons to do all these things. But why didn't you tell the world, eh? I mean, why is this a secret? I mean, the church has gone back and forth, apparently, learning this now, too. The church has gone back and forth over the years in being open with its membership and therefore with the world on where its money is, how much money it has, and how much money it's spending. They are currently in a phase of not telling anybody, even their own members, which, of course, would mean telling everybody, but why can't they just tell everybody what they're doing and explain it and justify it instead of having this bomb dropped on them and making them look bad, which legally they'll probably survive without a scratch, but it still makes them look bad, even to a lot of members.
And that brings up, how do other faiths account for the money that they hold and sit on, and are they public about it? There's a whole conversation there. But Nate, since there are other stories that we want to get to, is there anything that, we're missing from this story, and where does it go from here? The IRS could take some kind of action?
Could, with a capital C and capital O and all the other letters, too. As far as where we would go, I mean, this is a story years in the that's going to be covered years down the line. I mean, I've already had that conversation with an editor at the Salt Lake Tribune that we need to be thinking about this years out, because it could take the IRS, if it acts at all, to act on this. There's going to be questions about David Nielsen and what, if anything, he reaps from this, and what the fallout is personally. Is this going to create a sea change in terms of either the church being more transparent or members demanding more transparency? Someone from Salt Lake Tribune will be back here talking with you about this story for a long time,
Roger. I imagine so. The door has just sort of cracked open a little bit.
Yeah, and I think the other important thing to point out is that, aside from how the money has been spent, a huge takeaway is just what the number is at all. $100 billion just in this investment fund that doesn't even start to count all the other assets of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Real estate, for example.
Yeah. All the previous estimates of the church's monetary value have been way low. I mean, they were every journalist or professor, anybody that ever tried to do an analysis was off by like at least one digit, for the last couple decades anyway.
I want to just actually one question occurs to me before we head to another break. And George Pyle, it's that what about the idea that this is, I mean, $100 billion. It's twice as much as Harvard has in their endowment. There were a bunch of comparisons that were made in the Washington Post article and elsewhere. But, I mean, even the newly nonprofit Salt Lake Tribune is trying to build an endowment that can fund operations. You wouldn't have $100 billion, obviously. But,
well,
yeah, you would hope.
We wouldn't turn it down.
Right.
But, yeah.
But you know, but what about the idea that it's just an endowment? And this is how, you know, this particular nonprofit is choosing to fund its operations, et cetera.
Yeah, well, it's been a controversy with the church. It's been a controversy with Harvard. It's been a controversy with other institutions. I mean, there's this drive now from some people to say, if you're rich and you want to give away money, don't give it to Harvard. They got lots of money. Give it to Salt Lake Community College. Give it to the California state system that needs the money. But people like to give to institutions that already have a lot of money because it makes them feel prestigious. And there's a big article in the New York Times about the Museum of Modern Art, which just opened this huge expansion. And now it's like, well, do you really need all this money? And you can't be on the board unless you give them $1 million. So there's it's not just this church. It's lots of well-known institutions that have a lot of money, and you could think you might think, why aren't they spending the money for the benefit of people who need it? And why are we giving them money? They've already got a ton. Give it to somebody who needs it.
All right, that's George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. We've also been hearing from Nate Carlisle, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a one-minute break. We'll be right back.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll scale some lofty peaks in search of music from the mountainous regions of the world. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Mountain Music, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Last week on Wait, Wait, our panelists gave their expert opinions on the Democratic race for president.
There's like, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell. Yeah. It should be like, you don't have a blue merch chance in Iowa.
I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in this week as we talk about all the incredibly unlikely things that happened anyway on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr, Nate Carlisle, and George Pyle. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You know what? We've got some little bit of time left here on the show. And so, Nate Carlisle, I'm going to stick with you for just a little bit longer and some of your coverage from this past week. And it also has to do with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a change of policy for children of polygamists. What was that change in policy?
Yeah, at one point I thought this might be the big Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints story of the week. I just,
you were mistaken.
We just got beat out by a nip of $100 billion. For years, decades, I don't know how long, if you were a child of polygamist and you wanted to convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you had to take some extra steps that included, right, the word is repudiating, or repudiate, in singular, I think it is, in the what was the bishop and stake president's handbook on this. You had to repudiate your parents' beliefs. And if you were a minor, you had to move out of the parents' house. Those requirements have been removed from the latest handbook.
This is very similar language to something we've heard before.
Yes. And this was it was similar language for the children of LGBTQ parents. In fact, when that November 2015 policy came out, the church pointed to the policy on polygamous children as a predicate for creating the policy on the children of LGBTQ couples. And so we know, of course, that the church removed the LGBTQ policy earlier this year, and it's also now that in 2019 they've deleted this policy on the children of polygamists. So if you're a child of polygamist or a child of an LGBTQ couple, you now can convert to the church the same way everyone else can.
Was there, and this is sort of an odd question, but was there any kind of equivalency, you know, in the church's eyes between polygamists and people who are LGBTQ? I mean, or who are married as same-sex couples, for
example?
That's
an interesting question, because a few people have pointed out that the church had these specific exclusionary policies for the two groups that they saw as a threat to the LDS church concept of family, gays and polygamists. And they were, these two groups were put together in the president and stake president and bishop's handbook.
Okay. And so this just goes into immediate effect. I mean, deleted. And so that's just something that children don't have to do anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
children of polygamists and or LGBT.
We're not even sure exactly when it was deleted. We know it was sometime this year. This is in a handbook that is not made available to the public. It's for lay clergy within the LDS church. You know, some copies have been leaked online. But actually, this particular passage only made it onto social media this week, and a few people noticing it. The church did not promote that it deleted this policy.
I was going to say, no press release, nothing like that.
No.
Okay. I'm gonna call that story right there and urge people to check it out at sltrib.com. And I'm going to bring in Thomas Burr for one last story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. And that is a local politics story. You reported this morning, Tommy, that Representative Rob Bishop is weighing a run for governor of the state of Utah. When will we know whether he is running or not?
Well, originally we were going to know in November. That's what Bishop kept saying, that he was going to, you know, make his announcement by Thanksgiving. I talked to him this week, and he said in January that Bishop will decide whether he's going to jump into the race. And you know, he said he already knows what he's intending to do, but he's not going to announce it until then. It sounded, though, I mean, he had already kind of mapped out how he thinks he can win, how much money he thinks he's going to need, how he thinks it's actually easier to run in a crowded field, because, of course, we know we have John Huntsman in the race.
Right.
Cox is in the race. Amy Winter Newton is in the race. Jeff Birmingham's in the race. You know, there's already several people who are campaigning, and but Bishop thinks, you know, because there's so many people, that means you only need to get 25 to 30% of delegates to the convention to actually, you know, get to the ballot. So we'll see. But Rob Bishop isn't running for the House again, so he could be running for governor.
One or the other. And then there was another sort of interesting tidbit in your article, which is that he, if he does run, says that he's not going to gather signatures to get on the ballot per state election law. Well, the count my vote law. Do you want to talk about that just really quickly before we head to our underplayed stories?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So Bishop is a person who does well at conventions. The delegates like him, and he's never had a problem at a state convention before. So I think he's looking at this, well, if I run for governor, they already have my back. So in this situation, while some of the candidates like John Huntsman are going to gather signatures, Rob Bishop's just going to go with the route that has been used, you know, for the past generation of going to a convention, getting delegates to vote for him, and if he ends up in a primary or as the GOP nominee, that's his path forward. He also noted that way he doesn't have to spend as much money or raise as much money, because he doesn't have to pay to gather signatures. And he joked that everyone really knows him already, so he doesn't need to run any ads to introduce himself.
Okay. And we will see, I guess, in January whether or not he's running. And I've not given George Pyle, the columnist, an opportunity to comment on either of the last two stories, but I'm not going to let him do it here either.
That's
because
okay.
We need to turn to our final...
I have other means for
okay.
doing that.
Right. Final segment, underplayed stories of the week. And George, do you actually want to kick us off with an underplayed story?
Well, I don't know if it's underplayed because it's just coming out. What I'm reading now and I'm going to read is the Salt Lake City Police and their internal review of this, what I thought was a police riot when they were protesting the Inland Port and took their protest to the Chamber of Commerce,
right,
which had been trying to sell influence on this matter and gave up when it was exposed. this is not the last word on that. It's already being condemned as a whitewash by the protesters and the people who are opposed to the port. So this is going to go on for a while.
It was a raucous protest. I was there. We covered it on the show, and it was a very interesting moment in time. And so this review finds that there's no wrongdoing by the police.
Yeah, it says, you know, it doesn't completely forgive the police for everything. It was a volatile situation, and tempers were high, and it indicates, yeah, maybe we could do a better job, but they're not going to take any responsibility for it, really.
George Pyle's pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Nate Carlisle, we'll turn to you for your pick for Underplayed Story.
Well, I'm taking the entire statewide college basketball landscape, pardon me. What? That's an underplayed story. I mean, you've got the Utes beat Kentucky this week.
Amazing.
In Las Vegas, which few people thought could happen. Utah State University, the Aggies, they're in the top 25 and may very well still be the best team in the state, but they got beat by BYU in the swan song of the Beehive Classic. Right. Which is part of the story in itself. They had this sort of college basketball tournament just for the state teams. It didn't draw as well as like some LDS Wardhouse pickup games. And so they're doing away with it just as it looks like college basketball may be making a comeback in the state. I mean, I think we've gone a couple years without any school even. Well, sorry, the Aggies made the tournament last year.
Right.
But, you know, this was a college basketball state once upon a time, and that kind of waned, and now it may be coming back.
Right. Once upon a time, and once again now. Okay, great pick from Nate Carlisle for underplayed story of the weekend. Thomas Burr there in Washington D.C. Your choice for underplayed story.
Yeah, sure. So about one year ago, we entered what turned out to be a 35-day government shutdown. It was not so much fun for federal workers or for people who needed some federal services. And this totally got underplayed this week because there's this whole impeachment thing, and there's Democratic debate, and there are a lot of other things that were going on in Washington. But Congress actually passed a budget. The president's expected to sign it. We won't have a government shutdown again. And I think we should send them a gift basket to Congress and thank them for doing their job.
Okay. All right. Tommy Burr with his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. A government not shutdown, I guess I should say. I'm going to go for my part with a story by Taylor Stevens. The headline was Investment Banker Convicted of Illegally Importing and Selling Machine Guns in Utah. This guy is facing up to 20 years in federal prison after a jury convicted him in Salt Lake City's U.S. District Court on Wednesday of importing machine guns from China and selling them in the state at a steep markup. On Wednesday, U.S. Attorney John Huber, in a written statement, said, "In this day and age, there are few transactions more dangerous than an anonymous and unregulated exchange of cash for machine guns." Ain't that the truth? Let's see. We've got Nate Carlisle, George Pyle, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining me on Behind the Headlines this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks.
Yeah. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for their support of the show. You can find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great Christmas holiday and happy holidays in general. We'll see you again next week.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and heard online at upr.org.